for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Fighting in Libya is now in its third week. Many say the desperate situation unfolding there demands some kind of international response, but there's no consensus on just what to do. In the U.S., Senators John McCain, John Kerry are pressing the Obama administration to enforce a no-fly zone over Libya. Joining me in the studio to talk about the situation and debate over military intervention, Jessica Matthews. She's president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Tom Shanker, Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times, and Danielle Pletka of the American Enterprise Institute. We do invite your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Tom Shanker, if I could start with you, what are the latest reports on what's happening in Libya?
Right. Well, the Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi made his usual dramatic appearance last night, showing up at a hotel in the capital of Tripoli. All the correspondents there gathered in the lobby, but he chose to be interviewed just by one, a Turkish correspondent, whose report was released early this morning, Diane.
They waited for about 7 hours for that interview.
Right.
Did they not?
Well, yes. I don't know what their production issues were, but what Gaddafi said was rather interesting. He really drew a line in the sand, if you'll pardon that old metaphor, saying that should any outside power attempt to impose a no-fly zone, that the Libyan armed forces would rise up, and Gaddafi pledged his people would support him. That part of it is, of course, very uncertain and, of course, wrong, but his pledge to attack and try to defend against a no-fly zone is certainly something that military planners have to look at, and it shows that if intervention is ordered, it would have to be a forced entry over, you know, a Libyan objection, and probably it would look a lot like war.
What areas of Libya do the rebels hold now? What areas does Muammar Gaddafi and his supporters hold?
Right. Even though the country of Libya is the size of Alaska, all the activity that we're seeing right now is really in a belt along the Mediterranean coast. That's where the population is. It's where the cities are, the oil infrastructure. Gaddafi, of course, owns the capital. In some ways, he's really just the mayor of Tripoli and no longer the leader of Libya, because there are strong uprisings both in the east of the country and in the west.
Now, there were reports going back and forth yesterday that Muammar Gaddafi and a rebel leader were talking, that Gaddafi was saying he had an offer to exit. Any truth to that?
Well, one of the problems with that, Diane, it's the same one that's sort of bedeviling the American military as they try to reach out to the rebels to discuss possible support. We don't really know who the rebel leaders are. We don't know if there's one faction or many. So while Gaddafi may have been in contact with a rebel leader, it is hardly a unified opposition acting as a coherent armed force.
Tom Shanker, Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. Turning to you, Jessica Matthews, the Obama administration has said all options are on the table. What does that mean?
Well, it means that while they attempt, I think, to avoid military intervention, they don't want, they want to keep the pressure building on the people around Gaddafi. And I think one of the important things to remember in all this is most of this is not directed at him, but it's directed at what remains of a regime around him. There are any number of possible kinds of intervention. Of course, the no-fly, no-drive zone, which would be even more demanding on us, but also the questions of whether there needs to be a ground component, not necessarily American, and indeed probably not American, but perhaps from the Arab League or the African Union. Organization of potential humanitarian protection zones, arms embargoes, arms sales, identification, location of assets, and freezing of assets. a big part of what they're trying to do now, in addition to organizing multilateral consensus or attempting to find it, is to build a ratcheting sense of a closing in pressure on the people who still remain with him, in a sense that if you hang with him, history's not on your side and you're going to be punished for it. So all these steps are ways to try to do that.
So lots of options on the table and publicly talked about. Danielle, you say a public debate over these options is not positive. Why not?
I think it's not so much that we shouldn't have a public debate. Anytime you debate the use of U.S. military force, it's right to have an informed public discussion about it. The problem really is that the Obama administration's internal deliberations have been played out on the public stage. And so we've seen an enormous amount of disarray. The president was very quiet at the outset for reasons that he suggests of U.S. presence in Libya, U.S. diplomatic presence in Libya. Once our American citizens got out of Libya, he was a little bit more vocal, but he waited a little while to call for Gaddafi to step down. We appeared enthusiastic about a no-fly zone at the outset. Then suddenly we were unenthusiastic. Secretary Gates was very unenthusiastic. Secretary Clinton seemed more enthusiastic. All of this is mixed messages that, first of all, confuse those we seek to help in Libya, confuse those we seek to intimidate in Libya, and confuse our allies about our intentions. It's really that public debate that I'm talking about.
What do you think, Danielle Pletka, could be accomplished by a no-fly zone?
It's a very reasonable question, Diane. We've taken to talking about a no-fly zone as if somehow it's going to be a panacea. And I don't think it's right to suggest that it would be. Let's say that we were able to put a no-fly zone in place with or without UN approbation and sanction. Even if we were able to do so, that wouldn't necessarily stop Gaddafi from using his ground forces, his artillery. A no-drive zone, even that would not necessarily stop him, and that's an escalation over a no-fly zone, which we haven't even decided we're going to support. But it would, I think, take away some of the momentum that Gaddafi has over the opposition. It would deny him the ability to intimidate people wantonly in the way that he has been, and it would be an important humanitarian step for us.
Tom Shanker, what would have to be in place to accomplish a no-fly zone?
Right. Well, now that we know Colonel Gaddafi has pledged to, reject and rebuff and fight back against it, if you look at the history, it would probably have to open with a series of missile strikes on Libyan air defense systems, their radars, their missiles, their command and control, even their runways. That is an act of war, attacks on a sovereign nation. But you'd have to do that to protect the pilots. The United States and its allies have large air forces in Europe. The carrier Enterprise has been sort of lollygagging in the Red Sea, moving toward the Suez Canal. Its exact speed is classified, but it could be off Libya in 18 hours or so once an order was given. With a carrier in place, with the air forces in Europe, you could do this. There's a command ship called the Whitney that's now docked in Italy that would probably put to sea to do all the command and control of a no-fly zone, and also to make sure that civilian and aid aircraft are not caught. But it could take several hundred aircraft, because you not only have to have the attack aircraft, Diane, you have to have search and rescue in place. You have to have refueling. You have to have AWACS and other intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. So it's a 24/7 mission that could require hundreds of aircraft at a time where Afghanistan is a great obligation, where Iraq is not completely silent, and where the administration has to look at other countries in the Middle East and balance its national security interests versus what's going on in Libya today. Could the military do it? Absolutely. Is it the right thing? That's the debate underway that Danielle referenced.
Is it the right thing, Jessica?
I certainly don't think it's the right thing now. Air power hasn't been decisive in this struggle to begin with. So as Tom suggested, this would not necessarily be the answer. But more importantly, it's an open-ended commitment. This is really the Colin Powell Pottery Barn thing. You're in. It's not that you've broken it, but you've bought it. And the how this will play out, both at the military level, but even more importantly, excuse me, I think at the political level, who the opposition is, whether the opposition can come together, what you do with a country that has basically no institutions other than the colonel. You know, in Tunisia and Egypt, you had two regimes who threw out the guy on top. In this case, the guy on top is the regime, and there's very little else of it. So you are faced with trying to govern or help govern a gigantic a country with nothing there.
But Danielle Pletka, what happens if we do nothing?
Well, that's really the great question, Diane. And I think that part of the problem is that while there should be doubts about a no-fly zone, I don't think it's quite the heavy lift that some want to suggest. I think it is eminently doable if we're willing to exert the will to do so. But there is a great debate about whether to do it or not. The answer, however, is if we do nothing, we don't return to status quo ante. We're not going to go back to the state where Gaddafi was quietly and comfortably repressing his own people with the support of, you know, Mariah Carey and the London School of Economics. It's not going to be like that. He is now a rat in a corner, and he is a dangerous, dangerous man. I want to analogize it perhaps a little bit imperfectly to what we saw in Iraq with Saddam Hussein. When we encouraged the people of Iraq to rise up against Saddam, told them we would protect them, didn't. He then spent the next few years oppressing the living daylights out of them.
Danielle Pletka of the American Enterprise Institute, Jessica Matthews of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Tom Schenker of the New York Times. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. As we talk about U.S. and U.N. and NATO options in Libya, do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jessica Matthews, as Danielle Pletka has said, you had First Secretary of State Hillary Clinton coming out and saying, maybe we need to establish a no-fly zone. Then Secretary of Defense Gates came in and said, people who talk that way don't understand the full impact. Danielle has just said, maybe it wouldn't take as much as what Tom Schenker has said. What's your view?
Oh, I think it's a very significant military commitment. And one has no idea where it ends. There are no easy lines to draw. People who say, well, we'll just do this, and it seems surgical and at a distance and safe. So what happens with the first person who gets shot down? And what happens if it doesn't work and you have to move to no drive? What happens if you actually have to ground helicopters as well as fixed-wing aircraft? Much harder job, much more intensive. It does require moving assets from elsewhere. But as both Tom and Danielle said, it's doable. The question is it wise? And the thing that seems a bit absent in the public debate so far has been the question of how deeply are U.S. national interests, as opposed to our emotions, engaged in Libya. I think we're seeing the beginning of a gigantic historical sweeping movement across this region, and there are any number of countries in which are far more important to our national interest than Libya. Saudi Arabia, Syria, Egypt, Iran. There's a certain degree here both of setting a precedent. We go here, why don't we go there? But also of keeping our powder dry for potential developments that we can't foretell right now that are far more important to our national security.
But let me ask you the same question I asked Danielle. What happens if we do nothing and other dictators around the world see us do nothing and see a Gaddafi-like figure simply open arms on their citizens, begin shooting, and we do nothing?
Well, first of all, of course, this will not be the first time we did nothing. 5 million people, 5 million people died in the Congo. 250,000 people died in Darfur. That's not to say that's a good outcome. But what I don't accept is no-fly zone or nothing. There's lots more, and there's lots more that we're already doing in between a military action like this and doing nothing. So I think that there is as I said earlier, a range of activities that can create a closing circle and a growing sense of threat on the people around them. They may well not be decisive.
Danielle.
I'm sort of very struck by something Jessica said just a moment ago. This is a question of U.S. national interest versus emotion. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Emotion has taken a big part in a lot of the public discussion about what's happened in Libya, in large part because it came on the heels of Tunisia and Egypt, and because Gaddafi's reaction has been so brutal, so disgusting. I saw a video yesterday of a little boy screaming in pain who'd been shot by Gaddafi's forces. That does bring out emotions. But I think it's fair to try and step away from that. Just looking at our national interest, which is a very proper question to ask, we have to remember who Muammar Gaddafi is. This is the man who brought down Pan Am 103. This is a man who was developing nuclear weapons program until he gave it up in the wake of our invasion of Iraq. This is a man who has a chemical weapons store. Now, we can say whatever we want about how things were 2 months ago. Right now, he's a man who has been condemned unequivocally by the President of the United States, almost all Western powers. He's not suddenly going to kill all the people who hate him and then rehabilitate himself as a member of society. That's a threat to our national interest and something we do need to anticipate no matter what.
Tom Shenker, let's talk about some of those other Western powers. Britain and France are reportedly going after a UN resolution to authorize a no-fly zone. What does it take to get that kind of resolution?
Sure. I mean, you would have to overcome the great reluctance of both Russia and China on the Security Council, both of those countries, for both internal reasons and international reasons. You routinely oppose resolutions for outside intervention in the domestic affairs of another state.
And have they already signaled such?
They certainly have. It would be very hard even for NATO to act without a UN resolution, although there have been instances in the past. I think the next step we should watch is Thursday. Tomorrow, there's a defense minister's meeting in Brussels at NATO. Secretary Gates, who today is at the change of command at Africa Command, which would be the American military headquarters that would oversee any Libyan mission. So you have Gates at Africa Command today, at Brussels tomorrow. What the defense ministers decide, whether action, no action, words or deeds, will be very significant.
What about the Arab League?
They are meeting and talking as well, although they don't really have the resources to impose a no-fly zone. There's also history there as well of not sending their armies into the army of another state in the region. I don't think that would really be the way it would go. But I think Jessica made a good point. There are a number of less invasive steps the U.S. could take, and some of them are already underway. There's a lot of American intelligence and surveillance resources now focused on Libya. That could be shared with the opposition. There's jamming aircraft that could fly in international airspace and sort of muddy the communications of Gaddafi's forces. Even supplying humanitarian aid trade into safe zones outside of Libya has an effect on internal politics. And I think there's probably some quiet communications with Gaddafi's inner circle, business leaders, military commanders, and others, as we did before the invasion of Iraq, saying, you need to think about your future. Which side of history do you want to be on? So the questions we're asking today about what side of history does America want to be on, those questions are being posed to Gaddafi's inner circle as well.
The current situation means that Gaddafi's forces fly over and bomb innocent people. What can we do to stop that now, Tom?
Well, again, we've been talking about these options. There's the no-fly zone. That's at the extreme. The one sort of step back from that would be to airdrop in weapons, anti-aircraft guns, that sort of thing, to the opposition. Try to enable them to more effectively enforce their own no-fly zone and defend themselves. There are logistical issues there. We also don't know who the opposition is, but it's a less invasive intervention.
Danielle, Gaddafi is saying any Western intervention would signal that the U.S. is really after its oil. How much is oil at play here?
Always a hard question to answer. I'll say the same thing that I always said about Iraq, which is that if we were really interested in the price of oil, we would do nothing, because the price of oil stays down when there's less conflict, and it doesn't matter who's in control. As long as someone's in control, the oil flows. The more there is on the market, the lower the price is. Period. End of story. This really, in my opinion, isn't in any way about oil, though I would say that oil has become a very potent weapon in the hands of both Gaddafi and his enemies, who now control Benghazi and possibly two other ports inside Libya. They are beginning to explore how they can use the resources of oil and exports to help themselves, and that's going to be very interesting as it plays out.
And there's I agree with everything that Danielle just said, but probably you have to play this out further, which is if we intervene in Libya, we may raise expectations elsewhere in the region, in other oil producing countries that we then cannot meet.
Saudi Arabia.
So, well, Saudi Arabia is Armageddon, but even short of that. So we also have to, this is incredibly important history, gigantic history that's playing out in a totally unexpected way. And before we leap in with something that seems both discreet and simple, it is neither of those things. And it has consequences that, just as when we first got involved in Afghanistan against the Soviets, you have no idea, then you have to think through what it may be like 10 years when those weapons and those people are turned around and shooting at you. So where are the expectations we raise and the commitments that we make that we then may not have available elsewhere is got to be a part of this decision also.
What if the UN should decide to somehow go in and establish a no-fly zone? What would be the overall objective there, Tom?
Well, the overall objective, of course, would be to suppress flights of fixed-wing aircrafts, the fighters and bombers. More difficult but possible is to keep the helicopters on the ground. And it's interesting, Diane, over the weekend through yesterday, attacks by the combat jets dropped by 50%. And it was mostly helicopters. So even Gaddafi is sort of setting his own military agenda, thinking a no-fly zone is coming. Well, what would happen if there was a UN resolution, and I know American policy, they would try to make this as international and as large a coalition as possible, trying to get as many European, North African, Middle Eastern countries, so it wouldn't be a no-fly mission stamped made in the USA.
But would all those countries be willing?
Well, that's a very good question, but I think more of them would be under the cover of a UN resolution. And even if they were supplying modest numbers of aircraft or planners or vessels, so it wasn't a U.S.-only mission, I think that's one of the things that this administration would make as its priority if it were to move ahead.
Well, suppose you can't get a UN resolution. Would you want to see the U.S. go in nevertheless?
No. Diane, that's a softball to me. I'm not as concerned about UN resolutions. We waited for a very long time and saw many, many lives lost in the Balkans because we couldn't get a United Nations resolution. And I think that I'm not in the least bit sanguine that we're going to be able to get a UN resolution allowing a no-fly zone in Libya. The one thing somebody said to me yesterday, which I think was absolutely true, is the more that the Chinese and the Russians see that we are committed to pursuing this no matter what, the more likely it will be that we will be able to get a resolution. If they see that as the sole avenue that we are willing to use, then they are absolutely going to stand in the way. So we need to be pretty aggressive about diversifying our routes forward. Even if that's not the end of the game, we still need to explore all the options.
Daniel Pletka of the American Enterprise Institute. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And let's go first to Arlene in Garden City, Michigan. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Diane, I'm calling because I recall when we were talking about going into doing a preemptive strike to Iraq so many years ago, we didn't consider the blood and treasure that we would have lost as a consequence. I don't know if people are looking at it the same way, but it seems to me if the defense secretary says, no, this is not prudent, why not listen?
Danielle.
Well, I think Arlene is absolutely right. We should listen to the Secretary of Defense. But at the end of the day, this is a decision that needs to be made by the president. And frankly, I would have liked to have heard what the president wanted before I heard the debate among his cabinet as to whether this was or was not a good idea. Will it cost in blood and treasure? I hope it would not cost in blood, but you can never be sure. Will it cost treasure? Absolutely. We do need to weigh all of those questions as we look at the humanitarian crisis in Libya and make a prudent decision about the right way forward.
Jessica.
I don't think I have anything to add on that, except perhaps to say that we do have an overstretched military right now. This would require the diversion of some assets and from other theaters. I think what Secretary Gates was trying to say is that this is not a trivial undertaking.
Right, exactly. All right, let's go to Mindy in Germantown, Maryland. You're on the air.
My point is, whatever happened to negotiation, why can't we go and bring the two warring parties to the table to negotiate a peace settlement? Why must it always be the first impulsive reaction that we have is to go to war, to supply arms to one side? This is not one side dropping bombs on innocent people. This is a civil war.
Any possibility of negotiation out there, Tom?
Well, I mean, as we've heard today, Gaddafi says he's speaking with one of the rebel leaders, but we don't know whether that rebel leader is truly speaking for the entire group. And just to make clear, the U.S. is not dropping bombs. They're not supplying weapons. The negotiations that your listener is talking about would be something internal to Libya, but the American government has been very judicious in moving forward. They didn't leap to intervene.
Let's go to Athens, Texas. Hi, Charlie.
Yeah, hi, Diane. I just want to stress something about what it's going to take to do a no-fly zone, okay? I helped plan and was on the scene in 1986 when we went into Libya. Let me remind everybody, at that particular time, that was just a single strike that went in over a few-hour period, okay? We had three aircraft carriers that had to be on station to do that. We had the 42nd Electronic Support Electronic Combat Wing out of England, the 48th Tactical Fighter Wing involved in it from England. We had huge diplomatic problems because nations like France didn't want us overflying their country and then dropping bombs on somebody else. So anybody there that thinks that this is a easy undertaking is very misinformed.
Tom?
If I could just add to that very cogent assessment, one jet was also shot down, and there were reports of civilian casualties from American bombs that went astray. So not only is it a difficult undertaking, but there are huge risks both to those carrying it out and to innocents on the ground.
Jessica, would you be in favor of a UN-sponsored move?
If the situation gets to a point where we could see that this would make a decisive difference, and if we can get a multilateral agreement that has at least a token role for the Arab League and the African Union, I think that's critical. And if we feel that there is no other way we can avoid a massive humanitarian catastrophe, that gets close to my conditions.
Jessica Matthews, she's president at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Short break. More of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org, by the David Geffen Foundation, supporting the vital role of quality journalism in this nation's civic life, and by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
NPR CEO Vivian Schiller has just resigned. We'll focus on what this means for the network and federal funding for public broadcasting. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We have many callers waiting. We'll go now to Terrence in Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a little advice from ancient Greece, from a commentator, Thucydides, commenting on the Athenian mood at the time of the Peloponnesian Wars. Okay, here we go. The ability to understand the question from all sides meant one was totally unfit for action. Fanatical enthusiasm was the mark of a real man. I hope someone takes that advice.
All right, thanks for calling. Jessica Matthews, you think it's important not just to concentrate on the U.S., but on other countries. Seems to me that's taking in all sides.
Yeah, this is a series of events of just enormous historical consequence, just huge. And as always in a situation like that, there's a ton of uncertainty, but I think the long-term potential here is enormously positive for the U.S., but its importance, I think its historical importance, is sort of in direct proportion to the degree that we are not involved. What made Tunisia and Egypt, what has transformed those countries and transformed the Arab mood across the region, was the sense that people rose up and did this themselves, and that it was not about any ideological ism. It was about individual liberty and dignity. We need to keep that in mind as we make these decisions also. I've been just struck by how quickly this discussion tends to become about the United States. What can we do? How do we feel?
What should we do?
Our first thought has to be about what it feels like in the region and what its meaning is there. And an intervention by the United States, even under multilateral cover, although that may ultimately be unavoidable, will change that.
Danielle.
We were talking about this a little bit during the break, and I said to Jessica that what struck me is that the United States has played a role, and it's a role that I think we need to examine very carefully, because the people in Tunisia and the people in Egypt and the people in Bahrain and elsewhere have stood up against rulers that have been supported for decades by the United States. And I think that the United States, and this is a very nonpartisan slam, is complicit in supporting the dictators that have been bedeviling the lives of hundreds of millions of people of the Arab world and Iran. And we need to examine exactly why it is that we were less open to the rights of these people and why we were so unwilling to see them articulate those hopes for freedom, lo, these many years.
Well, we know the answer to that. I mean, the answer is very clearly we chose oil and stability over uncertainty and
human
political
freedom.
Reform.
Tom Shanker.
Well, I guess my only thought to what my two colleagues on the panel have said, and if your listener was able to quote his favorite analyst, Thucydides, I'll quote one of my favorite strategic thinkers, which is Spider-Man, who said, "With great power comes great responsibility." And I think the United States has historically sided with dictators for national interests. But I think since the street revolts began, I think one can see a number of steps the government's taken to show great restraint. The Defense Department, Secretary Gates, Admiral Mullen, the chairman, reached out to their counterparts in Egypt, delivering a very clear message. Your military cannot attack the people. You are an army of the nation, not of the government. And I think similar dialogues are underway with Bahrain and Saudi Arabia today. And so, perfect or imperfect, I think this government is trying to exert its power with responsibility.
All right, to Gilbertsville, Kentucky. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have just one question, because the oil, from my understanding, from Libya, actually is sold more to the European countries. And we're not hearing anything from the European countries of their involvement, or maybe I'm missing it. And I am glad to hear that we're pushing more for the Arab countries and African countries for their involvement. And I don't believe we should be involved other than what you're discussing this morning. And I appreciate this really good discussion this morning. And I always thank you for your programs, Diane. They're excellent.
Thank you for listening. Danielle.
Actually, I think the caller is a little bit wrong. The Europeans really have been surprisingly forward-leaning on the question of Libya. David Cameron, the Prime Minister of the UK, was really out in front. He was one of the first who was talking about the possibility of a no-fly zone. He and the French President Sarkozy, German Chancellor Merkel, all have been very forward-leaning, were out in front of the United States in condemning Gaddafi. On the question of oil, that's true. Libya does absolutely supply more oil to Europe than to the United States. But of course, that is irrelevant. Oil is a bucket, and it doesn't matter where it's sloshing around in the bucket.
Would the UK and France take joint action without the United States? Tom?
That's a question that's certainly under discussion, and we'll hear more about that Thursday at NATO. The British in particular have done combined operations with U.S. military very effectively, and there have been NATO missions in the past, such as in the Balkans, that were undertaken without a U.N. resolution.
All right, to Princeton, New Jersey. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Diane. I may have misunderstood something earlier in the program. I had expected that you had at least one journalist on there.
We do. Tom Shanker, The New York Times.
All right. Well, my comment was, as someone who does a lot of writing herself, I'm always fearful, and it certainly happened during the invasion of Iraq, when journalists, and that's not to single Mr. Shanker out, refer to their own support of a position of a government. In other words, when one says, we, meaning the United States, I think journalists should remain above the fray and speak independent of their citizenship in any matter, especially regarding war.
Tom.
Well, sure. I think you could scrub my comments today and you would be unable to find any political view or endorsement of any political statement. If I use the word we, well, I am an American citizen.
Absolutely.
And although I'm a journalist for a great newspaper that is very objective and independent, I am a citizen of this nation and I'm happy to use the word we.
Thanks for your call, Linda, to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Angie.
Good morning, Diane. My concern is very, very profound, and it affects many countries, as we've seen in the last years. Please listen to me. I know it's difficult to understand me.
No, it's fine.
Okay. We have been in many countries intervening, Somalia, Ivory Coast, Congo, Darfur, and that has not changed a thing. Instead, it has encouraged factions to divide and also seek the support of the United States or any other countries. We don't want to reward any kind of internal rebellion in any country because that is not the way to go. We want to encourage people to talk to each other, or if they have their own problems, they should negotiate it. And if we go to the UN, I don't see a country that doesn't have internal problems that will vote to crush another country because it's preventing an internal rebellion.
All right. Thanks for your call, Danielle.
Well, I'm a big believer in people power and in people standing up to their governments. I think that dialogue is always the right choice when dialogue is possible. When one side is in prison, when dissidents are being tortured and murdered, then dialogue becomes difficult. And that's the situation we find ourselves in Libya today. So up the rebellion, as far as I'm concerned.
Here's an email from Mark in Baltimore. He says, why is the argument always in the context of national interest? Is there no moral argument for us to get involved there? Everyone talks about sweeping changes taking place in the Arab world. If Gaddafi succeeds in turning back the rebels, how much of a chill will that put on other movements toward democracy? Jessica.
I'm not sure, that it will be a tremendous chill. It will be significant. There's no question about that. But the distribution of power in each of these countries is totally different, and the forces at work. So the only country I think that has a region-wide impact is Egypt, and that has an enormous. If what had happened in Tunisia had not happened again in Egypt, its importance would be tiny. So you can't really tell, but the moral arguments go both ways also. And as we've talked, and what happens too easily in the U.S. when we think we can use our hammer and we've found a nail is to forget the national interest argument, sidestep it.
Lynn sends a message on Facebook. She says, if Gaddafi is thrown out, do your guests have any idea who they would feel comfortable with in replacing him and why? Danielle.
Well, that's really the biggest problem with all of these dictatorships is that when you spend decades repressing civil society, what you find is that when the dictator disappears, you have two elements of an opposition. One, an opposition that is in disarray as a result of years of aggression by the dictator, and two, the Islamists, those who have been able to organize in mosques, one of the few areas that really remain not completely, but partially sacrosanct in the Muslim world. And so it's a very fraught question. If when Gaddafi goes, what comes next? I don't think that we have any idea, and I don't think the people of Libya have any idea either.
Tom Shenker, would you agree?
And that's certainly one of the problems that the military planners are confronting, both as they try to figure out who to help and who to, you know, coordinate with. But if you look at, you know, using the phrase, you broke it, you bought it, should there be an American intervention, whatever government follows Gaddafi would in many ways be America's adopted son and daughter. We cannot shed responsibility. We don't know what could come next. It could
be
very bad.
But now look at what's happening in Egypt, for example. There is this difficult transition period to find a leader, and some of the old guard is moving back in.
Or never left. I mean, one way you can look at what happened is that you have the Mubarak regime minus Mubarak. So the question of how you can get from today, I mean, almost every day as the protests have continued, there's been another slice off that regime, and there's been a lot of movement. But allowing enough time for non-Islamist parties to organize and come into being, and at the same time so that the military moves out of a governance role, the primary governance role, that's a balancing job that's just phenomenally difficult.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to John in Eunice, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, ma'am. I am from Sierra Leone, and I have witnessed firsthand what Gaddafi did to support the rebels in Sierra Leone. If America is trying to intervene out of moral grounds, then why not Sierra Leone? Why not Liberia? Why not Congo? Why not Uganda? Why not Rwanda?
Is there a clear answer, Tom Shenker?
Well, I think that's probably the sharpest and smartest question anyone could ask right now. And, sir, I salute you for calling in with that. That is how the question of national interest versus humanitarian need has to be balanced. Yes, we are all human beings. Yes, we feel so badly about slaughter. But if the U.S. cannot intervene everywhere, how does one make the decisions where to intervene?
All right. And on that very question, to Galesburg, Michigan. Good morning, Chris.
Thank you. This country is constantly talking about democracy and people's rights. And for years, decades, we tell people to rise up against their leaders. And that's what they do. And then we don't support them. We get involved in mistakes like Somalia, which hamstring us from going into Rwanda. We got involved in Iraq, which makes us afraid to do this. And there comes a time when people rise up, and a small push from us could lead to a great movement. As far as quotes goes, Mark Antony to the Romans, there comes a tide in the lives of man when taken at the flood leads on to greater victory.
We have many, many classic scholars in our audience this morning. Thank you for that call. Danielle, how much support is there in the Congress for Senator McCain, Senator Kerry's point of view to go in with a no-fly zone?
That's a very interesting question, Diane, and I'm not sure of the answer. We've had a couple of members of Congress express some serious reservations. I think Senator Lugar, the ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee yesterday, and Senator Kerry's counterpart actually expressed some doubt about it. And I don't think we know. But I think the caller also makes an important point, which is that this is a job that we tend to do when we focus on it because we're drawn in by a rebellion in Libya or in Egypt. But this should have been a job that we assigned ourselves for many, many years. The truth is that helping democracy movements isn't about coming in, flying in at the last minute and saying, hey, guys, let's meet with you in a Starbucks on the corner. It's really about helping to build institutions along the way. And I would say that we have not put enough emphasis in our foreign policy on that institution. institution building in a whole variety of countries, sometimes for rational reasons, but we really need to rethink that.
Last word, Jessica.
Well, that opens a gigantic box, and you know, we are always juggling conflicting interests. In the case of Egypt, we were looking at a regime which had made peace, albeit a very cold peace, with Israel, that supported us in our efforts to find an Arab-Israeli settlement, that worked with us on keeping the situation in Gaza under some control and against terrorism. Democracy policy is never easy, and it's never a matter of the rebels are just the good guys.
Jessica Matthews of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Danielle Plutka at the American Enterprise Institute, Tom Shanker of the New York Times. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones.